Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would
be biased.
It's Wednesday, March 14th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, back with Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. It's time for our weekly critique of the media and the issues stemming from the things they do. Rush Limbaugh's opponents appear to be hitting him where it hurts, in the wallet. Meanwhile, the argument about sexist language and double standards is spreading, and the Obama campaign is apparently distancing itself from a comedian who gave the president's super PAC $1 million. Better watch what you say on Facebook. A new study says exposing your political feelings could damage your friendships on the social network. A documentary about child soldiers in Africa has become the most viral YouTube video ever. It's stirring young people to act, or at least share, but some mainstream journalists say it oversimplifies an important story. An 85-year-old newspaper columnist has also gone viral this week. Lots of folks are defending Marilyn Haggerty's review of the new Olive Garden that just opened in her hometown. And a New York marketing agency is in hot water for helping the homeless by turning them into human Wi-Fi hotspots. We begin again this week with the growing controversy over Rush Limbaugh's recent on-air remarks. You'll all recall, of course, he called a Georgetown law student a slut and a prostitute for advocating mandated insurance coverage of birth control for women. We're going to start off, Lee, by focusing on the fact that since we talked about this last week, some 100-plus advertisers have now pulled their spots from the show. At least one local radio station has started running a lot of PSAs, these free public service announcements, in spots where they would normally run very pricey ads with Rush Limbaugh's show. And the syndicator for the program, the national company that sends it out to some 600-plus radio stations, acknowledged that over the next couple of weeks, it's not going to require stations to plug in what they call barter spots, basically national spots that run so that the local stations can also have their advertising on the Rush Limbaugh show. Does this signify something important? I mean, is it inevitable now that that Rush is in deep, deep trouble, or is this just sort of an early warning system, but soon we'll be back to normal?
I hate to say this because it's going to sound cynical, but right now I think soon we're going to be back to normal. Some other controversy is going to come up. It's going to push this one off of the front pages. The difference would be if there were some sort of concerted, and it probably would require social media, but not just that, effort not only to get advertisers to boycott the show, but then to put pressure on the local stations that are carrying the show to dump it. And the problem with that is you'd have to replace it with what? And there's not a ready replacement. So I think the all of the entropy, if you will, is to go back to the normal.
I don't know that I disagree with you, Lee, but it does seem to me, Charles, that there is some sort of concerted campaign out there using social media. Local stations are being asked, being pressured in some markets at least. And we see that, you know, for example, Bloomberg just released a survey, I think today it was, showing that just over 50% of Americans say they think Rush Limbaugh ought to be fired. We have folks like Jane Fonda and Gloria Steinem are trying to get a campaign going to have the FCC intervene. So is this piling on going to mean anything in the end?
Imagine Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda really whip up the Rush crowd pretty well. It remains to be seen, but I know a week ago when we sat around and discussed the same thing, I would have never dreamt that you would have over 100 advertisers who have pulled. I mean, not temporarily pulled. They're gone. Because if there's one thing you notice about sort of controversial content and when advertisers walk, they walk. They don't, you know, take a two-week break and come back when it's cooled down. They're gone. Because they have just deemed that content too controversial. So he's radioactive to some extent. And I don't think it has as much, at least personally, I don't think it has as much to do with sort of the boycott attempts or those kind of things as it does the sort of viral effect of one advertiser turning to another advertiser. Because particularly when you're talking about hotel chains and retailers and mass manufacturers, those people are in touch. The marketing people in those companies are in close contact, particularly the media buyers who do radio. And if it reaches a point where it's just too radioactive, then you enter a death spiral.
So I mean, certainly he's radioactive at the moment. The big question is, what's the half-life, right? Or will these advertisers be coming back at some point? And I do see a little bit of pushback coming from some folks who normally are not defenders of Rush. We have one blog post, for example, up today where a columnist is saying, what is this business with Jane Fonda and others suggesting that the FCC get involved? That's a pretty big hammer for this little bitty nail, isn't it?
Well, it's a pretty big hammer. I was wishing that the person who'd written that had listened to Charles last week, because I think Charles has the perfect response. The argument that was made, I believe it was by a guy who was writing in Fortune, was essentially that government shouldn't interfere with anybody's right to speak. And of course, the argument that Charles has made is that government shouldn't interfere with your right to speak. You can go out and say whatever you want on the corner of 9th and Elm. The catch is you don't have a right to say it on the radio to tens of millions of Americans in the same way that you have the right to speak on the corner of 9th and Elm.
But also going back to essentially, you know, the fairness doctrine kind of standard at the FCC, I thought we'd kind of gotten beyond that of using whatever this nebulous in the public interest means when you're talking about a talk show expressing political opinion.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty, I don't know, strident rhetoric by Fonda and Steinem. Imagine that. But I think their larger point is pretty valid. I mean, a point sort of buried in their column, which was, this is the worst this guy said. He said a lot worse. And I think that's where he's got to be worried. Is if people start examining the entire sort of playbook of Rush Limbaugh, it's pretty remarkably offensive. And if advertisers are sort of reminded of that, then they're going to be really scared to come back and other ones are going to drop off. And, of course, the great irony is this is the free market doing him in.
Maybe he should be afraid, and maybe he truly is, but he doesn't act like it in public, at least, Lee.
Oh,
I mean, on the air now, he's gloating over a new CBS News New York Times poll that shows President Obama's approval rating down and down with women, despite all the attention about his dust-up. So he doesn't sound like he's somebody who's afraid of losing his job.
Well, megalomania takes many forms, and when Rush equates Obama's poll numbers to something that he personally did, that is not logic. I don't know what it is, but maybe crazy thinking, but logic it's not. I think the other point that Steinem and Fonda are trying to make is that Rush has an awfully big microphone. There's nobody out there to sort of counter him in the marketplace in any sort of systematic way. And that's the real puzzle in all of this, is how do you actually get powerful, diverse speech in this marketplace.
We're also hearing a lot more this week about this sort of moral equivalence or false equivalence argument that we started to talk about last week, Charles, whether liberals and conservatives turn the other cheek when a media or a political figure they like says something that's truly crude or sexist or racist or whatever. Well, the right this week has been focusing especially on Bill Maher, the comedian with the show on HBO, who's given $1 million to President Obama's super PAC. He also said some pretty nasty things about Sarah Palin. Jon Stewart poked fun at Fox News for raising this issue.
People on the right were going, hey, wait a minute. There's a guy on the left, Bill Maher, who hosts that show on HBO. He says really reprehensible things about all sorts of people.
Maher called Governor Palin the C word and the T word.
What? C and T? No, no, no. Palin can't be both Captain and Tennille. It can't be possible. It's not, you can't cut.
Of course, you know, it isn't just Fox News, and it wasn't Captain and Tennille. I mean, we know the words were really, truly offensive. And I just point, I mean, Charles, you raised the question about this sort of false equivalence last week. But I have to say there's a really interesting column we got up on our blog this week from the woman who writes She the People for the Washington Post. Her name is Melinda Hennenberger. And it's really quite fascinating. I'm just going to read just one quote from it right now. She says, This determination to find our political adversaries guiltier of misogyny than anyone on the home team goes back at least as far as Bill Clinton. If there's a line partisans wouldn't cross to defend their own, I haven't located it. What do you think of that?
That's very interesting. And I think, you know, misogyny is misogyny and should be condemned roundly. The false equivalency still exists. Bill Maher is not Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is not Bill Maher. I mean, one key distinction, which Stuart sort of teases at in that piece, but I think we could elaborate upon, is the fact that Bill Maher is a relatively minor comedic figure on the outskirts of leftist politics. I think there are some liberals who find him hysterically funny. A lot of other people are deeply offended by him, particularly spiritual people, because he's also a very public atheist. Rush Limbaugh, on the other hand, is the ideological figurehead of the Republican Party as it exists today. He has been recognized on the floor of Congress. There's a huge difference between the two individuals. And, of course, the Obama administration is running from Maher as fast as they can. We've yet to see the GOP establishment run from Rush.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they feel quite the need to do so, but you mentioned the campaign is at least sort of distancing itself. We've seen one signal of that because David Axelrod, who's one of the campaign leaders for President Obama, has decided all of a sudden not to appear on Bill Maher's program. Haven't seen anybody say yet that they're giving back the $1 million from the super PAC. The White House, of course, wouldn't announce that, but I wonder if that's not the next shoe to drop.
It may be the next shoe to drop. I mean, part of what bothers me is that we don't seem to have a vocabulary where we can be critical of one's opponents without personally annihilating them. And that gets back to what, you know, what Charles said is, you know, anytime you have to criticize, I don't care who it is, somebody's political ideas by calling them a nasty name, the shame is on you, not on your political opponent. We're smart enough and articulate enough to figure out ways to not have to do that. That's part of civil discourse. And that, I think, shows, in essence, what we've lost. The other thing that bothers me is that American politics has become this absolute run for the middle to the point where the middle doesn't want to acknowledge that there are extremes of thought that at one time or another have actually informed the way that common government has gone. I mean, there was a time when it was extreme to think about integration in this country, yet we've moved. So, I mean, that bothers me too. Political discourse is not everybody getting together in a circle and singing kumbaya.
Well, let's talk about one new form of political discourse, and this one that was highlighted by a study that came out this week by the Pew Center's Internet and American Life Project. And Charles, what they found was that most people don't talk about politics on Facebook, the most popular social medium in the planet. But when they do, some people are easily offended. And something like 1 in 5 people who talk about their politics to their friends on Facebook lose some of those friends or decide themselves to drop friends because their political views don't associate with theirs. Now, who's doing this mostly? It's the people with extreme political views. The survey found folks who are more to the left or more to the right of the spectrum are more likely to unfriend their friends, and liberals slightly more likely than conservatives, apparently, to take this ultimate act of defriending somebody. What do you make of that study?
I think it's really interesting. We had a term. I grew up in Georgia. We called it culling the herd. and I think there's a certain element of that taking place. I mean, if you go to my Facebook page, it is a no-holds-barred political conversation most days. I got friends all over the university community. I have a lot of friends from high school in Georgia. It's a right-left crowd, right? I mean, big time. And I get in some of the most interesting conversations down that thread. And I have a lot of people over time going, thank goodness for your Facebook page, because this is where I come and fight. And by fighting, I get a lot of links exchanged and I learn a lot. Thank you for that. And I think there's some of that going on as well. I think when people are hidden, at least in my world, maybe yours too, I hide people that are openly bigoted or profane. That's when I get rid of them, when they just have lost touch.
Lee, what do you make of this survey and the unfriending?
I think it explains why I'm so rotten at dinner parties, because like Charles, I regard a good conversation as healthy political debate. I don't want to talk about the weather, and I don't want to spend very much time on what my bracket is for March Madness, although I realize that I do have to engage in a little bit of that. But most folks, I think, regard politics in general, let alone strongly held political opinions of any stripe, as radioactive, as unfriendly, as and something that is not social. Where for me, for the three of us, it's actually about the most fun you can have on the planet. So yeah. I kind of want to do this, but it explains a lot of my lack of social graces, I think.
I thought one other statistic from this survey was really fascinating, is that many people on Facebook don't know what their friends' political leanings are. And when they find out what they are, they're surprised. 38%, almost 4 in 10, said that they discovered through a friend's post that his or her political beliefs were different than what they thought. So I don't know what that means. But
I'm totally that person who people are hiding. I'm sure I have as many people who've hid me as friended me.
Well, they're calling it the most viral video ever on YouTube, and since being posted a week ago Monday, the Coney 2012 video has been viewed more than 70 million times. The 30-minute documentary was produced by Invisible Children, Inc. It's a call to action against Joseph Kony, the rebel leader in Central Africa, who for more than 20 years has kidnapped kids and drafted them into his army. The charity's Jason Russell narrates the video. He begins by telling the story of a young boy named Jacob and his promise to put an end to the enslavement.
Over the past 9 years, I have fought to fulfill it. And the fight has led me here, to this movie you're watching. Because that promise is not just about Jacob, or me. It's also about you. And this year, 2012, is the year that we can finally fulfill it. And if we succeed, we change the course of human history. But time is running out. To level with you, this movie expires on December 31st, 2012. And its only purpose is to stop the rebel group, the LRA, and their leader, Joseph Kony. And I'm about to tell you exactly how we're going to do it.
And then for the next 20 or so minutes, he does that and talks about the campaign. And in some ways, it's a very moving video, Lee. For folks who haven't seen it, if you're not one of those 71 million people, you can go to our page and have a look at it. But there are also a lot of folks who are criticizing it, who say that it's simplistic, or that it's not quite factual, and there are lots of other criticisms. What's your initial take on this phenomenon?
Well, my students did a brilliant job, of discussing sort of the media implications of this video for about 45 minutes today. And among the things that we talked about were, there is a graphic in the video that basically says, well, here's the power pyramid, the people are on the bottom, and what this video is trying to do is to take that power pyramid and turn it upside down. We talked about how that was a really simplistic analysis considering the rest of the content of the video, which actually asks you to go to opinion leaders and George Clooney. We all agreed we wanted to go to George Clooney, but that probably opinion leaders were a little bit better. One of my students also gave me a term that I'd never heard before called slacktivism, which is the notion that doing something is the equivalent of doing thumbs up or thumbs down on this video or linking it to somebody else. So we talked a lot about the difference between doing that kind of thing and what it would actually mean in terms of, I'm going to use an overworked phrase, blood and treasure for our government or any other government to go and capture this person, and this is my personal belief here, take him and put him on trial in The Hague, which is where I think he belongs. So, I mean, we had what I thought was a really smart, savvy conversation about, you know, do we really want to turn this guy into a celebrity? What does it mean for him to become a celebrity? All of that sort of stuff. I think it raises some fabulous points.
Yeah, Charles, I thought this, I hadn't heard of slacktivism before either. I thought it was really kind of a fascinating concept. And if you do look at at the video, there's some aspects of it which at least older folks like us might poke a little fun. There's an action kit with bracelets and stickers and a web awareness campaign. And it does seem sometimes to be a little unfocused. On the other hand, you do have an entire generation that's doing more than most folks our age are to look at an issue that everybody wants to hide, and especially something coming from Africa where we pay very little attention to it.
I was struck watching it immediately of South Africa and how we didn't have YouTube videos in the 80s when we were talking about disinvestment on college campuses like this one in South Africa. But it started in much the same way with what you would call slacktivism back then, which was, well, I'll go attend a brown bag because some speaker's coming in and that will assuage my guilt.
Or I'll build a little shanty town on the quad or whatever.
I might learn a little something.
Yeah.
That's how activism – I think these days activism will be born of slacktivism, really. The idea that forwarding a video or liking something is meaningless, I think, really, really sets the bar awfully high. I think engagement is engagement. And when we talk about it in media metrics, that's all we talk about is engagement. And yet when we get over here, a lot of the critics of this piece have said, well, it's awfully easy to just watch a video. Well – how many videos are you not watching? Thousands.
One of the arguably more complex criticisms of this whole campaign, and maybe more substantive ones, comes from folks who say that it just plays on that classic white man's burden sort of approach to problems in Africa. You see, what can all these white kids in America and around the world do to take care of the problem in Africa? Do you find any value in that criticism?
For me personally, that doesn't have a lot of traction because that's not how I see my students defining themselves. I don't think that they think of themselves as white people in the sense that white man's burden implies. On the other hand, I think that as we were talking about it in class, all of us saw it as an opportunity for more journalism. One of the stories that I really liked, Mike, that you put on the blog is one that talks about how much, if I give a dollar to this outfit, mm-hmm. how much of my dollar actually goes to doing something about this as opposed to promoting it, making another video, and all of that sort of stuff. And so here again, I think it's an opportunity for more journalism. But journalists aren't going to fix this. Governments are going to fix mm-hmm. this. And that becomes the real issue.
That was a good piece of journalism, though, to point out what percentage of the money goes to overhead versus mm-hmm. services. Interestingly enough, though, this charity responded with another video right away on YouTube, trying at least to address those problems.
Yes, and they're remarkably efficient based on that video. I think another part of this sensation is you watch the video, at least I did, thinking the whole time, what about this video made it so compelling? And I still haven't figured that out, but I think it has something to do with both the narrative flow and the imagery, of course, is pretty gripping. But I think that action kit, however cheesy to people of our generation, really resonates among younger people. I mean, I think he had audience so brilliantly in mind, and his audience was not us, I hate to say. His audience was a much younger demographic.
I do think it was kind of ironic, too, and interesting that some – big star journalists, celebrity journalists like Ann Curry or Anderson Cooper, who have parachuted into Africa and told this story from time to time in the past, seemed really kind of put off when they were interviewing the folks from this charity. Like, well, how come our stories weren't getting the kind of attention that you're getting? And John Stewart is a really good spoof of that.
Yes.
You can watch that as well. Yeah. Well, here's another example from this week's news that shows the pros and cons of going viral. Marilyn Haggerty writes for the Grand Forks Herald in North Dakota. Last week in her Eat Beat column, she gushed about the new Olive Garden. Her review became a social media hit. In fact, I found out about it from my daughter in American Samoa. At first, people poked fun at the old lady with her small town take on chain restaurants. But her defenders quickly pushed back. Even urbane New York food celebrity Anthony Bourdain cautioned against the snarkiness. As the local ABC News affiliate reported, Haggerty was a bit overwhelmed by all the attention.
The 85-year-old says she doesn't have any big-time goals from here on out, but she did tell me to keep an eye out for her next review, The Drunken Noodle.
I do what I do because I like what I do. It's just...
You still don't get it.
I don't get it.
At least she's everywhere now. She's been on all the networks, the cable channels, websites, magazines, Facebook, Twitter. kind of fun to watch folks who are kind of coming to her defense.
Well, in truth, I want to grow up to be Marilyn Haggerty. I'm not yet 85. I think she's set a standard that maybe with a little luck, some of us might be able to reach. I think the other thing that is that it, part of it, what is at the core of this is she's so blasted authentic, and it's very hard to poke holes in that. She does what she does. She's not putting on airs. She was too busy to find out about all the stuff that was going on Twitter and all of the rest of the social media universe, because she was writing enough columns so that she could go on vacation. I mean, this is just the sort of thing that you don't see laid out for you all that often, and I really appreciate it.
You know, Charles, I also thought that although you probably won't read such an earnest kind of review here in the Columbia Tribune or the Missourian, I bet if you asked the average Columbia resident, you know, what they thought about the opening of a new chain restaurant here, they might be not a lot different from Haggerty.
I've been waiting for the review of the Texas Roadhouse that opened recently. Her son, by the way, is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. So yeah. The DNA there is strong.
You know, Olive Garden must be loving the pushback, too. There was an MSNBC blogger who must really love the breadsticks and the unlimited soup and salad bar, because she wrote, while it isn't going to win any James Beard Awards, it's also not a Quonset hut full of raccoon meat. So that's kind of damning with faint praise, maybe, but I'll bet Olive Garden kind of likes this.
Oh, I'm sure Olive Garden likes it. And I do think it plays into something that we all kind of know. We all have our favorite, whether it's a chain restaurant that does what it does really well or a local restaurant that you won't find anyplace else. Every community has its places like that. And for the in people, they get to find that out. And she's kind of bringing that to everybody.
Well, let's discuss a charity campaign that was unveiled at another sort of hotspot for social media, South by Southwest conference in Austin, that was going on this past week. A New York advertising and marketing company decided to try something a little different. They said they were going to, and I think they actually meant this part of it, they were going to help homeless people raise some money. And in fact, they guaranteed them $50 for about 5 hours of work or any additional money they could bring in if they would agree to carry around with them a wireless hotspot so that all of the digitarati there at South by Southwest could get that great signal. And so homeless people from Austin were recruited. They're walking around. They've got the hotspot. You give them a tip or some money, and in exchange, you'd think, well, that's kind of interesting. But boy, the lid just blew off of it. People calling it everything from, dystopian, cynical, shameful, patronizing. What did you make of it?
I'm still back on digerati, Mike. That's a great word. I got to work that one into a sentence soon. I actually thought it was a violation of their humanity in many ways. It was, you know, me using them for whatever my ends are without considering what their real needs might be. So I guess I thought it was gimmicky and smarmy and actually pretty tawdry.
Of course, I mean, the marketing firm didn't have their own branding on the T-shirts. They gave all the money to the homeless people. It was more than you could make for minimum wage. So was that a fair trade-off?
It's one of those things where you can walk away going, okay, they might have had a decent concept. And even a noble thought behind it. But the execution was so flawed that it came off as, I mean, the word that leaps to mind is exploitative. It looks like they were exploiting these people for their own marketing purposes, and that I don't think they meant to. I mean, based on what I read and the reaction, they looked stricken, not just because they were catching all kinds of grief for it, but I think they were genuinely hurt by what they thought was sort of a warm-hearted story.
I just wonder, though, if we aren't to the point now where to cut through all of the clutter, even if you're trying to do good, you've got to do something crazy like this, or you've got to have a viral video that pumps up your charity or whatever it is. It just seems to me like there's more and more pressure to do something outrageous, even for good causes. Well, before we sign off, we'd like to offer our condolences and good wishes to the family of Henry Hager. Henry was one of our colleagues and one of the most beloved teachers in the Missouri School of Journalism. He died last week from complications associated with Alzheimer's. Henry was 85 years old. And we'd like to thank you for listening and watching our program this week. You can do so again by visiting our page on the KBIA website under the Talk Shows tab. You can also leave comments and suggestions there or via email at views@kbia.org. Our technical team this week, as always, is Director Travis McMillan with the Reynolds Journalism Institute, KBIA audio engineer Pat Akers, and student producer Chelsea Myers. I'm Mike McKean. Lee hosts the show next week. Please join her, Charles, and Linda Kraxberger for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.